Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this podcast, Professor Jeremy Black talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about how he might perhaps have lived his life had he been a historian living in the Britain of the 18th century rather than now.
Professor Jeremy Black, we're taking you in the time machine back to the Christmas period in the 18th century. First of all, which period of the 18th century do you think you would have felt most comfortable in and why?
Well, by the 1780s, you've got a lot of optimism. You've got the country stabilised as a result of the Pitt the Younger ministry winning the 1784 general election. You've got economic growth. I think that would have been quite nice. I mean, obviously, it was all to be swept away by the long war with revolutionary and then Napoleonic France. But there were a few years that were really, rather good.
So, okay, we will choose that period, and we assume you are still a professor. You've got a choice if you're going to be a professor in England of one of two universities. Which university would you feel more comfortable in at this period, do you feel?
Well, I mean, the universities had the same... You're talking about Oxford and Cambridge. They had the same problems as they have today. That actually most talented people were elsewhere in that period, in London or Edinburgh. Not as universities, but, I mean, you know, if you're looking for talent, raw talent, London, Edinburgh, or indeed Glasgow, the Glasgow of Adam Smith. So there's a lot of mediocrities, plus ça change, and there's obviously patronage, nepotism, and all the rest of it. But, you know, if you wanted to have a comatose world of plenty of food, and if you're a professor, I mean, I wrote a number of articles about Edward Nares, who became Regius Professor of Modern History at Oxford in 1813, so it's a bit after our period. And he, in the end, I mean, he remained Regius Professor for many years, but he, in the end, spent over 20 years not giving a single lecture because he got rather fed up with the place and he preferred to live at his rectory at Biddenham in Kent. So, yeah, one could be an academic, but I think if you wanted real intellectual stimulation, you wanted to spend your time somewhere else. Not, as I said, no different to today.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you were a historian, I mean, neither Oxford nor Cambridge had history faculties in this period, how would you have gone about writing history, or indeed the fact you wanted to write history, would that be a reason why you wouldn't be at Oxford or Cambridge, but perhaps writing books in London?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question. And as you may know, I have actually written a book about, I think I called it Charting the Past, about history in the 18th century. The dynamic feature in history, historical world, is entrepreneurial publishers are major centres, London and Edinburgh. All the great writers, historical writers of the period, were neither academics at Oxford or Cambridge. It is, of course, the great age the 18th century is the great age of historical writing. And if you're just thinking about people whom you might know in other lights, John Wesley, one of the key founders of Methodism, or David Hume, the philosopher, they, of course, both wrote histories of England. Obviously, you've got Edward Gibbon, we haven't even mentioned yet. I mean, Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations includes a short history of the world, as it were. So I think you've got a great age of talent, and you would have wanted to be part of that entrepreneurial London world, though obviously you would probably have needed, as a result of that, if you wanted to be comfortable, something else as well, to give you a bit of money. I mean, but Edward Gibbon, for example, had a civil service post for a little while and obviously had inherited money. But I think you would want to live in London.
Mm-hmm. Or might you be tempted to be a country parson writing antiquarian histories from the parsonage?
Yes. nobody would ever suggest that I would be eligible for that role. But then some, only a minority of those who held those posts weren't eligible either. I think that would be very much the case. And obviously, some of the greatest of 18th century historians were clerics. I mean, most famously, of course, Robertson in Scotland. Cox, of course, in England. Yeah. So, yes, no one could do that.
Well, someone in this period who has provided a great treasure trove for us now from the period was neither a great scholar nor a great divine, but Parson James Woodford. How valuable do you feel his diaries, I think not actually published until the 20th century, but how valuable do you think his diaries are to those of us trying to get a sense of a comfortable life in the second half of the 18th century?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I was given them to read for some reason when I was young. And then I think they were presented as a sort of, you know, they were these marvellous meals and all the rest of it. And it certainly doesn't give us an account of the Church of England comparable to that which recent scholarship has emphasised. People like William Gibson or Jeremy Gregory have, and many others, have drawn attention to the actual energy which a lot of 18th century clerics showed and have used that in order to decry the 19th century mythos about a sort of pre-reform sort of sloth. What I think Woodford and other such sources, and I mean, you know, sort of comparable sources, you could write a very interesting account of the pleasures of being in the early days of cricket, for example. What I think they do capture is that the 18th century was an age in which people were reasonably open about things, whether it's the food they enjoy or, I mean, in my book, Illustrated History of 18th Century Britain, I cited at some length remarks about sex. And of course, as you know, there is this account of the 18th century about, you know, the standard account presents it as an age of genteel politeness. And one of the points I was trying to make and and that in many senses, the genteel politeness is an attempt, a response to a very different world of often highly explicit sexuality. So I mean, one of the things I like about the 18th century, and I've read in my time, I mean, I've been lucky enough to, I think I first stepped foot in an archive with 18th century documents in it, in the manuscript room of the British Museum, as then was, now obviously it's moved over to the British Library, in 1977. You know, it's the fascination of reading people who would tell you what they think. And I'm a great believer in that.
So you're writing history, whether in London or Oxford or Cambridge. Where are you going for most of your research? Are you going to the Bodleian? Where in London would you turn to for primary research? Or are the cathedrals and their archives still very important to scholarship in this period?
Well, if you're writing on the history of England, by the late 18th century, I mean, obviously antiquarianism starts before that, and, you know, you've got some really quite distinguished people writing English history, people like Lambard earlier. But if you're looking at the late 18th century, there is a mass of material already available in charter form. And what you've got, I mean, I cited William Cox. William Cox in 1798 brought out a three-volume Life of Sir Robert Walpole. Of that, one volume was, as it were, the text. Two volumes were printed documents. And Cox spent a lot of his time on archival research. He did also Lives of Henry Pelham, of Sir Robert Walpole's brother, Horatio, of John First, Duke of Marlborough. And he also wrote, for example, A History of Monmouthshire. But he spent a lot of time doing archival research, much of it in family archives. And the same, for example, of Nares. Nares did a Life of Burley and very extensive research in Hatfield House. which had already been used extensively in the 18th century by people like Haynes. Now, Cox, for example, for Walpole, for Robert Walpole, used the papers at Houghton, the Cholmondeley Houghton papers, for the life of, used others as well, for the life of Horatio Walpole. That's Horace Walpole, but the brother, not the famous diarist who was the son of Robert Walpole. He used the papers at Walterton. Now, of those, the papers at Walterton are now in the, most of them, they are in the British Library Manuscript Division. The papers at Cholmondeley Houghton are now in the University Library at Cambridge. So a lot of material that is now in public repositories, were you to want to work on it, you would have had to go to either country houses or, for that matter, if you were interested, cathedral muniment rooms or the archives of city companies or municipalities. So you've got a number of historians of the period writing. I mean, I can think, for example, John Nichols, Whittaker. You know, these are people turning out histories of places like there's Leicester, there's... I remember reading History of Manchester. I remember reading a History of Worcester. All of these are drawing on quite good archival holdings, but essentially local archival holdings.
Mm-hmm. And this life of going around to country houses and other places of archival holdings, would that encourage you to seek a patron, even an aristocratic patron, or would you be more dependent on a contract from a publisher?
Oh, well, Cox himself had been a travelling tutor, which of course is a way that a number of people then ingratiated themselves and got a country living. In terms of writing for money in the terms of the publishing world, somebody like Oliver Goldsmith, who was very much an eclectic writer in a number of different genres, wrote A History of England, for example, which influenced Jane Austen, who also wrote A History of England, wrote, for example, A History of Mecklenburg. You know, George III gets married to Charlotte of Mecklenburg, Schwerin, I think it is, and... So what does the entrepreneur immediately do? Get Mr. Goldsmith to run off A History of Mecklenburg. Yes, I mean, if you're writing for money, that's a way to do it. Other forms of history, well, you get a certain amount which appears in bit parts in serial publication and then can be consolidated into a book. Some of those serials are, as it were, published in newspapers. So The Craftsman, for example, famously produces some of Bolingbroke's work in that form. And then, of course, you've got people can also publish a book and, in fact, try and cover its expenses by means of subscription. So you could... I seem to remember The History of Algiers by a man called Morgan that I read many, many years ago. You know, it was a subscription history. And with subscription histories, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't work. In fact, an interesting essay, if somebody's listening, that would be worth somebody's while writing, it would be books that did not come to fruition, sometimes because the people who wrote them were lazy rogues, John Wilkes, for example, but sometimes because the financing, didn't come through.
And would the newspapers of the period offer a writer such as yourself a possible living, or is that really just hack work?
Well, let's say, I mean, and remember, we're talking about some very distinguished people in the 18th century who wrote what you call hack work. I mean, I've already mentioned Goldsmith, not exactly a nobody, but I mean, Bolingbroke you could put in the same category. As you know, I've written several books on newspapers. Newspaper finances are complicated because we don't have... reliable accounts for any period of time for any newspaper that will enable us to get the notion of return on capital. What is the case, however, is that newspapers often, not always, were part of a more general publishing business in which the printer proprietor would both produce a newspaper. That newspaper, we're talking about particularly outside London, that newspaper would advertise books which the printer proprietor had either produced or was acting as an agent for. And on top of that, the people that took the newspapers round would also flog the books, or you could come and buy it at the newspaper office. So it's very difficult if you're looking at that kind of activity to work out, you know, cross-financing, to work out where exactly is the profit and loss. But no, I mean, you could then on top of that be financed by a political grouping to produce a newspaper. Not just you could, people were. As far as individual writers are concerned, unless you had a separate source of income, you had to be very successful to make money through writing, but that would be the case today as well. Most writers today, if you look at the Society of Authors figures, do appallingly. But in terms of being paid cash on the nail for copy, yes, people were doing that in the 18th century and sometimes turning out some very good copy as well. Pat Rogers wrote a very good study of what he called, what contemporaries called, but what he also used the term Grub Street. And I think one of the points that emerges, and this, you know, would still be true today, that although people today, you know, the great critics of, you know, are often very snotty about works that are written for money, are by writers who are primarily motivated for that factor, those were often some of the better writers and some of the more interesting ones. And indeed, I would say that this snottiness is being sustained at the present moment, not just by the size of the academic world and its particular attitude, but also by the literary reviews. Let's face it. I mean, there is an enormous amount. I mean, Private Eye was bringing it out only this week of backscratching self-regard in that world. And often some of the best works are ones that are not applauded by the literary reviews. And, you know, you had the same sort of thing in the 18th century. Factionalism played an enormous role, both individuals, of publishers and of politics, played an enormous role in the response to books.
Well, I want to turn from your professional life to your recreational side of things. What sort of thing, we're before the age of most organised sports, although cricket, as you mentioned, is very much up and running. What would you typically do to entertain yourself?
Well, it depends who you were and what your interests were. If there were some people who were, I think Sir Robert Murray Keith referred to them as the beer-drinking barons, by which he meant thick aristocrats who played sport and went hunting. There was the full range of activities. So a lot of people enjoyed themselves playing cards, having sex, getting drunk. A lot of people enjoyed themselves hunting. We're talking here about men. A lot of people sort of had different recreations and activities. I mean, you know, it's all over the place, as you would expect of a society which is largely free and which has the principal constraints are ones that are not too different to today for men. I mean, obviously, the political and social opportunities for women are much less than today. But for men, the principal constraints, which are disposable income and capital, are exactly what you would have today. The constraint of health is again what you have today. I mean, if you look at aggregate life figures for the 18th century, they're misleading because so many people died early on in life. I'm looking up my book here, 18th Century Britain. 38% of the children born in Penrith between 1650 and 1700 died before reaching six. But if you got to 20, your chances of getting into your 60s are pretty good. And of course, longevity improved, health outcomes improved from the mid 18th century. You've also got practices coming in like inoculation and then vaccination for smallpox. And also, if I might say something that to irritate people, but then I think one should try and get people to think. In the 18th century, I think people had a more robust realization that they were going to die and that that death was the end result, and you needed to be aware of that. I mean, it seems to me that one of the great problems in our response to COVID is actually that, yet again, we are a society that does not know how to manage the indubitable fact of death. But in the 18th century, they would have understood that. So, on the whole, first half of the 18th century up to the really dire economic circumstances, very poor harvests of the early 1740s, I think pretty tough. Thereafter, I think for the average person, whatever you mean by the average person, the actual life circumstances are getting better. And, you know, I'll stick myself in with the average. I myself would have died if I was in the 18th century, because I had an appendectomy when I was 21, and that would have been fatal in the 18th century. So I would have been dead. My daughter had a turning inside out of her bowel when she was a little baby, she would have died. So one's got to be aware of, you know, locating yourself depending upon your own personal circumstances from the perspective of today, or understanding yourself in its own times. Now, if I might say, that's one of the great differences between being what is called a time traveller and what is being a historian, because fundamentally a time traveller is not a historian. They are taking today's values and taking them back into the 18th century. Well, I can do that because I'm a historian, but it doesn't help us because it doesn't tell us what people would have said at that time. Whereas I think it's much more realistic to be not a time traveller, but to actually try and come to the sources of that period, understanding it in terms that make sense of that age and in that age. And, you know, you would have had people might look the same in modern accounts of plays from the period, She Stoops to Conquer, or when people do films of the Jane Austen, of course Jane Austen's at the very end of our period, they may make them look like today, but in fact they were living in a very different world, not least in the belief in terms of providential Christianity, which, you know, is one which is very hard to recover to the modern mind.
Well, I want to turn to the subject of a religion. If you're a gentleman academic in a major city, would there be, whether you were personally religious or not, would there be an expectation that you'd be seen in the pews on Sunday at the local parish church? And if you didn't do so, would that have been a significant social stigma in the societies in which you moved?
Well, I mean, let's move between being a gentleman and an academic. I mean, in the sense of Oxford and Cambridge, they're religious foundations, these colleges, and, you know, there wouldn't have been any real choice there. But if you're talking about, as it were, people who are not within that context, you could be not devout and get away with it. You might find it expedient to go in for what was known as occasional conformity, turn up once a year to take communion and mouth a few prayers, or you might not. Obviously it depended what you were intent on doing. For example, if you were a medic, medics tended to be people who were less associated, if you like, with public shows of devotion than teachers. So partly it depends upon what you're doing, and as you correctly say, where you're doing it and what career you want to follow. Some people are really for example, some Anglicans are, if we want to use that term, are very relaxed about what others do, particularly dissenters, and others are not. Others are furious and moves to repeal the Test and Corporation Acts, which, as it were, keep dissenters, Protestant nonconformists in England, out of office holding under the Crown. They're defeated on a number of occasions. I mean, I can think of five, 1736, 39, 87, 89 and 90. But there's also, of course, all the political rows of the 17 teens over that. So again, it really does depend upon what you are doing. I think that, I mean, again, it's ironical. There was a practice in that period which, in my mind, becomes clearer once the Jacobite threat has receded. There was a practice of, because you have adversarial politics, because you have the Toleration Act, because you have the lapsing of the Licensing Act, you have a practice of enabling people to say different things, which of course very much struck foreign visitors, people like Montesquieu or Voltaire, the extent to which there was extensive debate in public places, coffee houses, taverns, without people worrying about police spies. I mean, years and years ago when I was working on French foreign policy, I remember I went to look at the secret report, police reports, which were then in the Bibliothèque de l'Arsenal. We're talking about the 1980s. And there were sort of police reports to the government, essentially on what we're talking about, 1720s and 30s, about what was being said in, you know, such and such a place, by which you mean public places. Well, there's no equivalent in England. And so you've got a period of freedom. I mean, obviously, when there is the lengthy war with revolutionary France and there is a fear of pro-French movements in the British Isles, there is a degree of toughening up on the expression of seditious views, particularly in newspapers in the 1790s. But by the standards, I mean, again, what's interesting here, by the standards, for example, of World War One or World War Two, when general elections were stopped, you know, it was actually relatively freer society during the French Revolution in Napoleonic Wars. And of course, governments changed and ministries fell. And criticism was often very, very, very bitter in press and parliament. And again, I think what one's got as an historian, I mean, it seems to me that as an historian who is good, anybody can claim to be a historian, all sorts of people out there claim to be a historian, but they often have a very uncritical use of sources and an inability to contextualize. In fact, you know, I know this is supposedly light-hearted, but if I could make one very, very, very serious point, I think that what is popularly referred to as wokish, in fact, is a much more incessant, a much wider problem, which is the failure of people in all sorts of backgrounds to contextualize and their habit of being single issue and very broad brush, so that what they then do is lose any chance of both understanding events and texts and also contextualizing what happens. So, for example, I cited what was sometimes by very stupid people called the White Terror of the 1790s, or they call it the Pittite Terror. Well, all I would say is if somebody thinks that's a terror, they really should have got used to the idea of, for example, revolutionary Paris, where Hugh Gough's book on the, excellent book, if I may say, on the French press during the revolution reveals that a sixth of journalists were executed. Well, you know, you just don't get that happening in Britain. So I think one has to understand this point about context, which is something that is desperately lacking in modern discussion of the past.
Yes, well, we're assuming you're in London or the south of England, but if you got the stagecoach and went up to, let's say, Edinburgh, would you find both the religious and political atmosphere there in, you know, Presbyterian Scotland noticeably different?
That's, again, very interesting. I mean, it depends. I mean, obviously, if you were a high church English cleric, you might have been quite disconcerted to go to Presbyterian Scotland, where, of course, the Church of Scotland, which was Presbyterian, was the established church. But if you were somebody who liked the world of books, then actually, or for that matter, medicine or any one of 101 developing subjects, then going to Scotland would have been exciting, provided you stayed in Edinburgh and Glasgow, because obviously it gets a lot grimmer when you go to some of the small towns and rural settlements. And of course, you then move on. I mean, if you move by into the 1780s, 1790s. 1780s, you've got a more proto-romanticism. 1790s, you've got the romantic fascination with landscape, which you also see in parts of England and Wales. And, you know, you've got Gilpin and others writing about travels to places like the Wye Valley, the Peak District, and obviously the Scottish Islands and Highlands comes into that, and you're moving towards the early 19th century cult of Scotland, you know, Sir Walter Scott and, you know, Finkel's Cave and, you know, Mendelssohn and all the rest. I think it's fair to say that I would probably have found, by preference, I'd have stayed in Glasgow and Edinburgh and chatted to learned people in learned occasions and hoped to have caught some of their lectures. I mean, obviously, one of the many impressive features of Scotland was that the Scottish higher education system was infinitely superior and you could catch some first-rate people lecturing. Incidentally, I mean, one of the things I was always impressed years ago, I remember giving a couple of lectures at the University of Maryland, as my host called it, and I sort of mentioned to my host, you know, at lunch, that I was surprised to see so many elderly people in the lectures, but none of them had asked any questions. And he said, oh, under state law, any institution in receipt of public funds for higher education has to allow people who are pensioners in for free. He said if they wish to actually do coursework and get it marked, they have to pay for that. But if they just wish to sit in lectures, that's free. And I thought, wow, that was wonderful. Of course, one needs hardly say it hasn't happened in this country, despite the vast amounts of public funds chucked at universities. But no, I mean, the idea in the 18th century of going along and seeing a talented individual give a lecture would have been absolutely fascinating. And of course, on top of the institutions we're talking about, there were in many places, and Roy Porter wrote brilliantly on this for England, what he called the English Enlightenment, and obviously Scotland very famously a key element in the Enlightenment, these kind of popular scientific places, most of which you paid for by subscription basis. In other words, you would be a member of some society, a natural history society in, say, Norfolk or Northampton, and what you would do is you would get a set of lectures in which you would be introduced to new scientific developments. You would hear about what's known as popular Newtonianism. You would see, for example, an orrery demonstrated, and you may know that famous painting of the demonstration of an orrery. You might see somebody taking part in an early experiment of with electricity, and you know, you can see that also if you weren't up into Scotland, for example. You've got the Natural History Society there, which I think was founded in 1782, and you could have gone along and listened to the lectures, and you know, it would have been part of you improving yourself. I mean, the Manchester Literary and Philosophical Society was founded in 1779, the Norwich Natural History Society in 1746, and so on and so forth. And I mean, my favourite thing, as I said, is, you know, that I think Joseph Wright of Derby is a fantastic painter, absolutely wonderful painter. And that painting, you know, a philosopher giving a lecture on the orrery in which a lamp is put in place of the sun, which I think is an absolutely marvellous one. And as you may know, there have also been a number of works been written on the Lunar Society in Birmingham. So I think there is a degree, a dynamism in provincial society, which is very impressive. And of course, what we're not talking about are those who Kipling castigated as muddied oaths. But what we're talking about is people who have a commitment to understand or to try and understand through reason the world that they are in. Now, as we know, that has all sorts of imperfections, and some of the people that use the language of reason, some systems builders, are in fact ideologues of the worst and most intolerant type. But equally, many are not. Many wish to use it in order to understand the world that they are in and to try and apply solutions to devise and apply solutions. And when today you see so many people attacking Enlightenment values, you see, you know, ignorant people saying it's part of sort of westernization or whatever, and they come along with the belief that somehow that feeling something validates it as opposed to thinking about it, it's an absurdity. And it would have been seen as an absurdity in the 18th century.
Well, I want to take you back down to England, because I suspect Edinburgh was not so exciting at Christmas time. It's Christmas, you're in London, you're a person of some means and some social station. How would you and your family be celebrating Christmas in this pre-Charles Dickens world?
Well, Christmas itself was less prominent in that period. People gave presents usually on January the 1st, and a lot of places were open on Christmas Day, and you could actually have business transacted on that day. Obviously, the great religious festival was, as it still remains, Easter, not Christmas. But let us say I am a social individual, and let us say you've very kindly allocated me, this sounds very much like Desert Island Discs, you've allocated me funds beyond my current lifestyle. I would have liked to have been a member of the Society of Dilettanti, and I would have liked to have gone along to their places and, you know, their meetings and drunk heavily and discussed, you know, trips to Italy and neoclassicism. If one was in one's own home, I think one would have eaten quite well, one hopes. If one was comfortably off, it depended upon whether you'd had the good fortune to hire a cook who was good. And then to be in an intelligent position to express your views as opposed to just being bad-tempered about it. So I would personally have quite happily, I mean, I'm a meat eater, and I hope that doesn't shock any listeners, I would have, you know, stuck my my knife into a large trencher of meat and sort of cut my way in through it and enjoyed it. I would also have probably liked some of the very sweet confections, and I would have drunk quite heavily, and I would probably then have gone and reclined and, you know, read about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire by the latest volume, because it was a multi-volume work, the latest volume by Mr. Gibbon, and I would hope I would have enjoyed it. I might have been troubled by reports, if this was 1789, that the crisis in France was not going to be swiftly settled. I'm slightly worried about what this would mean for myself, but I would also have been in the very happy position, since I like reading novels, that the 18th century is the great age of the English novel, in the sense that you see many writers coming forward and a massive development of the genre. I mean, there are pre-1700 works that you could regard as proto-novels, but the great development of the genre is the 18th century. So I would have enjoyed reading my histories, reading my novels, eating and drinking, and then try to waddle off to the Society of Dilettanti. I hope that doesn't sound too terrible a day. Well, I'd have taken some snuff as well.
Well, it is Christmas. Professor Jeremy Black, we will leave listeners with that image of you on Christmas Day in the late 1780s.
And I want to say one more thing. So I would have taken my snuff. I'm afraid I would probably, since I would have had, you know, in the 18th century, people thought nothing of talking about their bowels and so on. I would probably have been blocked up. So I would have taken some rhubarb, which was frequently used in that period to help one get one's system moving. And I would have hoped to have then got a bit of sleep as a result of that eventually that evening.
Well, Professor Jeremy Black, we won't leave listeners with the image of you with your rhubarb, but we will leave them with the idea that you've dined well, drunk well, read well, and have toddled off to the Society of Dilettantes for your Christmas treat in the 1780s. Thank you very much for sharing your experience with us.
Thank you, Graham. And can I say how much I've enjoyed these this year, how I hope we will do very many more, and to say to listeners, Christmas greetings, seasonal greetings, if you prefer not to have Christmas mentioned, and the very best wishes. And do remember that, you know, in and among are the talk so often in politics and everything else about gloom and doom. Most people are still getting around with their life. The world's population is rising. The sun still rises every morning. Well, I know that's not quite how astronomy works, but do try and keep things in perspective. And one of the best ways to keep things in perspective is to be interested in history, because it gives you a much better perspective on the present than those who don't have or are unable to adopt an historical perspective.
Well, Merry Christmas, Jeremy, and Merry Christmas and seasonal greetings to all our listeners of Black's History Week.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.